Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray, and this week's show is brought to you by Remediant. Remediant makes a PAM solution that's quite different from the traditional password vault style solutions, and that's actually put them in an interesting situation lately, an interesting position with Gartner. Remediant scored an honorable mention as a, you know, as a PAM vendor to take a look at alongside Microsoft, funnily enough. But the thing is, they don't actually really qualify as a PAM vendor under most analyst rules because, you know, they don't require an agent and things like that. So this whole situation kind of demonstrates that the analyst firms might need to rejig the way they evaluate and rank various vendors, given that these days there's like more than one way to skin a cat. So Remediant co-founder Paul Lanzi will join me in this week's sponsor interview to talk through all of that and also to chat a bit about what Remediant's been up to more generally. That is coming up after this week's news segment with Adam Boileau, which starts now. And Adam, we got a lot of sort of day two coverage to get through this week, and we're going to start off with an excellent write-up, which of course is linked to in the show notes, from Huntress Labs. Huntress Labs have been all over this Kaseya incident. When we first spoke about it, you and I were at pains to point out that we didn't actually know how severe the impact of this Kaseya Reval ransomware attack was. You know, we didn't know if it was that big a deal. As it turns out, it wasn't a particularly successful ransomware campaign.
Yes, I mean, the original numbers that we saw when the Reval crew was saying, you know, a million boxes owned, a bunch of their headlines were very breathlessly saying, you know, the biggest ransomware attack ever. And certainly attacking from an MSP like this down into their, you know, attacking down through MSPs, you know, towards all of their customers, like a multi-layer supply chain sort of thing, like, has the potential to be exactly those things, right? To be really massive and significant. And I think we were expecting that. And it, yeah, it's kind of fizzled. And Huntress have written up this post kind of looking at some of the reasons, you know, potential reasons why that was the case. Looking at the information required to exploit the bugs downstream and a bit of analysis of the timeline of how Kaseya's response. So I mean, one of the things that they argue was that, you know, people have said it hasn't been as big because Kaseya reacted very quickly and shut down their cloud SaaS platform. But that wasn't actually involved in the ransomware component.
I mean, to their credit, they did tell all the customers to pull the plug, which is pretty radical advice, right? And look, what they lack in code quality, I guess they kind of halfway made up for in response in this case.
Yeah, they certainly moved quickly, and yeah, I mean, advising your customers to turn your product off. I mean, there's plenty of vendors that wouldn't do that quickly. So, I mean, I think there's certainly some positive things that have come out of this other than their ancient, you know, ASP code having horrible bugs in it. But yeah, so this good write-up of some of the reasons that maybe it didn't go as big as they thought.
Well, one of the reasons I found actually pretty interesting, which is even though there is that horrible auth bypass where you just leave the password blank or whatever, you still need a valid agent ID as part of that. And that's actually not that straightforward. Like obtaining one of them isn't, you know, something you could just look up or necessarily enumerate. I mean, you might be able to, but that's kind of one of the things Huntress said might have limited the attackers in this case.
Yes, it seems to be the case. They've looked at some of the logs and said, hey, you know, we don't see enumeration in advance, or we don't see another bug information leak being used to retrieve it. And, you know, they speculate on a couple of ways that this might have worked. But I think the main takeaway here is, you know, that these types of attacks, it actually could have gone to the scale, you know, that they initially claimed and that was possible. You know, you could absolutely imagine that happening. And there are other, you know, much bigger vendors, much bigger managed service providers and relationships between them that really could go that big. And we didn't see it this time, but, you know,
sure. Look, there's no doubt that this is a newsworthy event, right? There's no doubt that it's a significant event. But you got to realize, like, the reason we pushed back early is because the coverage was just so breathless, right?
It really was, yes.
Oh my God, ransomware actors using O'Day. And then you find out the O'Day is just garbage, right? And the attackers claiming to have owned, you know, a million boxes, and they're ransoming Kaseya, you know, for $70 million. Now, meanwhile, Kaseya has obtained a decryption key that works against all of these boxes that were successfully locked. It's very unclear how they obtained that key, though. They did not pay. They say they didn't pay. We saw some speculation from Lawrence Abrams at Bleeping Computer that the Russian government obtained this key and told Reval to, you know, go take a break and lay low for a while. I'm not really convinced that that's accurate, but I do think that Lawrence's coverage would probably reflect what he's hearing on the Russian criminal grapevine, right? And even if it's not true, I think that that being the general vibe of the grapevine over there is probably a positive thing.
Exactly right. I mean, there's a number of options, right? I mean, it could be law enforcement, Western law enforcement. It could be Russian, you know, political pressure plus law enforcement. It could be, actual hacking, right? It could be internal dissent.
It could be the Dutch, for all we know. AIVD went and just grabbed the key, you know? We just don't know.
That is how they roll. So there's certainly a bunch of options. I mean, the idea that the Russian government, that narrative would be very convenient for, you know, sort of Putin and Biden, you know, Biden applying pressure to Putin, Putin capitulating on the pressure. Like, that's a narrative that I could see being quite attractive, regardless of whether or not it's true. And as you say, the important thing is, like, if the Russian underground feels that there is the potential for pressure from their government and that their cover is not quite as flawless as it has been in the past, that's helpful regardless of you know, we may never know exactly how we got it otherwise. But, yeah, that's still a useful thing to happen.
Yeah, it is. I mean, meanwhile, though, we're going to talk through a few ransomware stories right now. I mean, we're still in the middle of a crisis, so let's not get too excited about one key being sort of rolled out. In South Africa, the port in Durban has essentially been shut down through some sort of cyber attack. I mean, nowhere is ransomware mentioned in the coverage, but I'm just going to go ahead and until I discover otherwise, assume that that's what's going on there. But, I mean, we've got trucks backing up and I don't know, you know, for people who've been following the news, things have been pretty bad in Durban. There's been a lot of civil unrest, a lot of violence, and, this is the last thing they need.
Yeah, I mean, when there's already disruption to logistics and supply chains and things from the unrest already, then, yeah, anything that affects, you know, trucks being backed up in the street absolutely is going to affect supplies and things that I'm sure are quite necessary. You know, ransomware is certainly the most likely thing, but, I mean, you know, there's entirely possible, given the rest of the unrest, that there may be other explanations. But, you know, that kind of infrastructure tends to be, you know, pretty slow moving in terms of, you know, patch cycles and refreshing of, you know, the hardware in a container terminal is designed to last for, you know, decades. It's not like regular IT infrastructure, you know, that is kept fresh. So, you know, that sort of infrastructure is, you know, a pretty easy target generally.
Yeah, I mean, it could have been ransomware. It could have been a red teamer being a little bit careless with Nmap, couldn't it, Adam?
I mean, you know, that is a, I mean, I having personally backed up trucks at the back of a container terminal, yes, it is straightforward enough to do, even by accident.
Now, you do not kiss and tell when it comes to talking about client engagements, even to me, in case anyone's wondering. Adam never tells me about jobs. I think you've told me two war stories in the entire time we've worked together, which is a long time. But I do believe, yes, you did cause a similar type of issue at a port once. And it's quite funny how that happened. It's long ago enough, by the way, people, that, you know, this story can be told.
Well, you know, sometimes you ask for, hey, you know, what things are sensitive, what things are going to break in the environment, what things should I stay away from? And if the list is empty, then, you know, clearly everything's robust. And, yeah, turns out, no, not so robust. A few packets here, a few packets there, and, yeah, next thing you know, trucks backed up in the street and bad times being had by all.
The Nmap scan that had a measurable impact on GDP.
Whoops. Oh dear. Yeah, I was sitting in the like IT admin office and all the phones started ringing and then you could kind of feel the pressure in the room going up and the eyes looking over at the, you know, pen tester with the beard. What row?
Yeah, it's funny. I remember one guy who we both know, who I won't name, he got himself into a bit of trouble when he was doing an on-site at a bank and he managed to take out a whole floor just by Nmapping. Because they were using like consumer grade switches, like D-Links or whatever, and they just couldn't handle it. So yeah, It's a thing that happens. And he got in trouble and he's like, I'm the one who's in trouble. Using a D-Link. What are you?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Oh, dear.
Getting angry at the wrong person. So we got some other, as I say, we got some other ransomware coverage to talk about. CyberScoop is taking a good look at some ransomware negotiations, like chat logs between the Egregore group and their victims. And, you know, every time that these sorts of logs leak, you can just see how sociopathic these people are.
Yeah, this is from work that came out of IBM X-Force. They managed to get hold of a bunch of logs from some of the Egregore crew, has been dead for a while. But yeah, the logs do give an insight into, as you said, like the way that, you know, people end up pleading and negotiating, and the, you know, in the end, people are criminals, right? They are not particularly caring about other people's feelings and situations and stuff. And that's, you know, hard.
But I've known criminals who are really nice, you know? Like, it's a special type of asshole who does this sort of thing. It's just the way I feel about it.
Yeah, no, it certainly is. And there's some other insights, I guess, in terms of the, you know, organizational structure of a modern ransomware crew. And like the Egregore was one of the first ones to use the affiliate model, but they would handle the negotiation centrally. So the affiliates were doing the deployment and then the Egregore crew would handle it. And at one point, actually, one of the people asking, you know, negotiating ransoms asks about, you know, what it's like working there, like how many people have you got working first tier support, and, you know, is it a great job, are you hiring? And the Egregore chat guy says, the work of communicating with so many customers is terrible. Thank you for your feedback. You know, tier one support is the same, you know, whether you're doing it, you know, at a telco or at a bank or, you know, here at a ransomware crew.
Please hold to rank my support by answering a quick questionnaire.
Exactly.
Some of the vibes there. The FBI, meanwhile, according to this story by Kevin Collier over at NBC News, the FBI is actually tracking more than 100 active ransomware groups. So, yeah, there's work to do.
Yeah, there really is. And I think, you know, the fact that this has been such a successful business model for so many people, you know, there's going to be copycats, there's going to be, you know, an expansion. This is a growth industry, right? I mean, it's really, it's on the up and up, you know.
Well, for now, let's see.
Invest in ransomware.
Yeah, Catalan has a report too about a new ransomware crew that's emerged, that's borrowed heavily from other crews, you know, past and present, and, you know, that's an interesting read. He's also got a write-up on the Black Matter ransomware gang, which is apparently targeting companies with revenue of $100 million or more, which seems like a sensible strategy because they're going to be the ones with the deep enough pockets to pay you. Now, here's a funny one from Catalan also. The Babook ransomware gang, their forum was getting ransomed, but in a slightly different way.
So this was the crew that did the Washington DC police, and then they kind of stepped out of the ransomware game for a while, I guess, after the pressure from that. And they had this great idea that they would stand up a new forum to replace some of the ones that had stopped taking ransomware business. So they you know, built up this new forum, and, you know, they're trying to turn that into a place for all the cybercrime people.
Yeah, they're trying to move up the value chain.
Yeah, exactly. Like, leverage their existing investment and move it up and, you know, pivot slightly. Unfortunately, someone appears to have taken issue with that has either hacked their forums or is just making lots of fake accounts and spamming their forums with pornography.
Yes, that's right. They said, give us $5,000 or we're going to spam your forums with gay porn, GIFs, and they didn't pay. And as a result, their forum got spammed with said GIFs. So, you know, couldn't happen to a nicer bunch of people, could it?
I mean, ransoming the ransomware crews, that's, you know, I mean, what are they going to do? Call the police?
Yeah, I mean, look, if anyone's bored and wants to do that sort of thing, spamming those forums and making them hard, like, yeah, why not? That's a good use of your time. I mean, speaking of good use of your time, the group No More Ransom, which offers, you know, unlockers and decryptors and stuff for ransomware crews, they've helped, apparently now they've hit the milestone of helping 600,000 people recover from ransomware attacks. Like, I mean, it's barely, the crazy thing is it'll probably barely make a dent, but it is still cool to see this sort of work out there, right?
Yeah, and I mean, this one's interesting because it is kind of relatively reputable. I mean, that's the thing. If you want to go get a decryptor for the ransomware, and it's one of the strains of ransomware whose crypto is rubbish and that you can just go get a decryptor off the shelf, having a trusted source for those is really, really useful, right? And that's obviously it's a small subset of ransomware that is sufficiently rubbish that this is an option. But when it is, you know, not having to go get some random EXE off a forum that's just going to actually ransomware you properly, this is a much better alternative. So that's good.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's just and it's something that people can do and feel good about. You know, by no means am I sort of trying to trash talk them by saying it's not exactly making a huge dent. It's a great initiative, and I would like to see them getting involved in forum spam as well.
Exactly. Good idea.
Now, we got some moves in the United States from lawmakers. U.S. Justice Department officials have come out in strong support of this. They're floating, it's been kicked around, you know, a few pollies at the moment, but they're floating this idea of mandatory reporting of ransomware events to CISA, which is interesting because we did see a similar proposal from the Shadow Minister for Cybersecurity here in Australia, Tim Watts, in recent weeks. So it feels like this is probably going to become a thing in a few jurisdictions.
Yeah, we've seen, you know, a bunch of people say, hey, you know, there should be laws against paying ransomers, and, you know, there's a bunch of downsides to that. And this sort of at least having visibility, because, you know, so many instances of ransomware or other types of intrusion we do see just kind of, you know, get covered up at the end of the incident response process. You know, so having visibility is super important. And this does seem like a reasonable balance between, you know, kind of, not, I mean, going straight out and saying, hey, you're not allowed to pay ransom crews at all, we'll just drive it underground. And that's the main argument against it, is you won't see cooperation with law enforcement, and it will make it harder to understand what's going on.
Some enterprises will simply disappear. I saw someone else floating the idea here in Australia that there should be some sort of, you know, liability for directors who pay, right? Some sort of, you know, actual sanction against directors who pay in this banning scenario. And I'm like, well, you know, then they're just going to put the company into receivership. They're not going to, you know, like, they're not going to want to get charged. So they'll just wind up the company. And that's the other issue here, is ransomware is effective because it can bring companies to a grinding halt. And their only option to resume functioning and paying their workforce and shipping their products is to actually pay the ransom, which is why you can't outlaw it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in the end, we end up in that kind of, you know, harm minimization sort of, you know, we have to make pragmatic, practical choices that actually work in the real world. And the idealistic, you know, you should just never negotiate with terrorists sort of thing is not necessarily always exactly what you need.
Yeah, exactly. But I think, yeah, it's a good idea. Get some visibility into the problem, you know, get a better estimate of the scale of the problem, and then you can make more informed policy choices. So I think this is a, you know, this is a law that I hope gets up in the US, and I hope it gets up here as well. Now, what else have we got here? Yeah, it looks like the EU is set to introduce a bunch of measures similar to the ones being floated by the US Treasury Department when it comes to Bitcoin. Looks like real know your customer and anti-money laundering rules are set to be introduced. So I think, you know, Bitcoin people, most of them I'd imagine, would support this sort of thing because, I mean, not the, you know, the weird, you know, coiner fundamentalists, but a lot of people in that ecosystem support the idea of regulation because it lends legitimacy to their, you know, planet melting, carbon generating project.
Yeah, and this kind of dovetails real nicely with better visibility of ransomware payments, right? If you know a much better, much larger degree of the payments, and you have much better monitoring of the payment systems, then you've got better tools to go and investigate. I think this kind of dovetails really nicely. And yeah, I think the EU following the lead of the US here makes a lot of sense. And yeah, you're right. The cryptocurrency people, you know, if you want to be accepted as a legitimate thing, which, you know, we can certainly disagree about whether, as you say, the planet melting side of it is appropriate, then yeah, this is kind of what it's going to end up look like. And yeah, I mean, hopefully they manage to pull it together in a way that actually works.
Moving on, and last week when we were talking about all these, you know, this Project Pegasus stuff and the, you know, the NSO stuff, and then we spoke about Kandaroo as well, another Israeli company that is apparently in the sort of exploits and intrusions game. I did say, I wonder at what point this sort of stuff is going to become a problem for the Israeli government. Turns out, Adam, the Israeli government is wondering the same thing.
Yes, we've got reports here from the Times of Israel saying that the Israeli government has appointed a special team to handle the fallout of the revelations around NSO Group and all of the publicity that's been getting around the place. You know, obviously Israel has a pretty sensitive relationship with you know, a bunch of the NSO Group customers, and you know, the Israeli government has always said that, you know, they only export things to governments, and you know, that all of the things that NSO say that they do in line with the Israeli government requirements, and then we have to kind of compare and contrast that with what's actually being reported. So yes, clearly the Israeli government is thinking about that as well. Whether this, you know, goes anywhere, obviously, you know, the very large nexus of cyber capability that Israel has, and you know, being in the weapons game is very much a thing that you know they're not going to want to hobble that industry too much because it's super useful, super valuable for them. But yeah, clearly there is diplomatic fallout, or there will be diplomatic fallout, maybe diplomatic fallout from this, and they got to think about it.
Well, they're trying to get ahead of it. I mean, the Defense Ministry has said that if it finds NSO Group violated the terms of its export licenses, it's going to take appropriate action. Whether that's just words or there's something real happening, it's kind of hard to say. But it is interesting seeing this kicking around at the upper levels of the Israeli government, right? You would think that NSO Group isn't the only capability provider in the country, so they better watch themselves.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm sure all of the other NSO Group-like companies, you know, in Israel will be watching very closely, and, you know, all of the, you know, conversations behind the scenes will be, you know, pretty serious to make sure that they understand, you know, what this is going to mean for them and whether anything is going to change or not.
Yeah, but I guess my point is, even if they take action against NSO, it's not like they're going to lose, you know, an exclusive capability set. That's
no,
what I kind of mean.
In the end, you know, the people will move on. There'll be other places to work.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Like squeezing a balloon. I think Tom Uren and I were having that conversation earlier. And yeah, we've got a series of headlines here that we're not really going to go into. You know, there's an interview. Tom Brewster did an interview with the CEO of NSO, and he's like, there was some interesting stuff in that, actually. This is the Forbes article where NSO says, no, they don't, you know, they're not capturing inline data to see who their clients are targeting, but they do have the ability to pull a target list when they want to investigate. And so they're saying they can get visibility in that way. Doesn't really make sense to me, because I would have thought target lists would be pretty closely guarded information among their customers, right? But it's still interesting nonetheless.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, NSO, I think last week when we'd just gone to press, NSO had put out a thing saying, hey, we're not going to talk about this anymore. This is all real dumb. So please shut up and stop asking. And then, yeah, a couple of days later, we see this interview with the CEO. So they're obviously, you know, vacillating around a little bit, trying to deal with, I think maybe this blew up bigger than they were expecting. I'm not sure.
Yeah. It's not their first rodeo, right? They weren't expecting this time to be just so huge. And it was huge, man. I remember knowing that this was going to be something. Initially, I was like, oh, do we even bother with this? You know, it's NSO being NSO. Probably being overstated a bit, right? Which is the bit that we focused on last week. But nonetheless, like, it's just the same story. And then I was listening to the radio, ABC News Radio, which gave us BBC News at the bottom of the hour and ABC News at the top of the hour. And the front story in both of those was Project Pegasus, right? And you're like, okay, right, this is big.
Yes, yeah. We've certainly, you know, got a bit more mainstream, you know, coverage, and, you know, having big names, politicians and journalists and people, you know, on that 50,000 phone number list definitely gave it more legs than some of the previous ones, because we never wants to see specifics, you know, when we're talking about things like this. And they had, you know, specifics, and I'm making air quotes here, and that definitely got more attention than some of the earlier stories that were, you know, really limited in terms of the number of people, a number of things they could specifically attribute to in terms of targeting.
We don't have any more clarity on where that initial target, you know, alleged target list came from. So it's a little bit hard for us to add any more value in this week's coverage. But look, Adam, we got some more absolutely hilarabad Windows issues to speak about this week. You know, time warp stuff. Talk us through it.
Yeah, so obviously it's been a bad kind of month or two for Windows Active Directory, and this has continued. There was a French researcher called Gilles Linel who came up with a bug called Petit Potam, which is kind of another instance of NTLM, like Windows authentication relaying. So there's a kind of a core design level issue with Windows Active Directory auth, where, you know, you can take an incoming auth request from some particular system and then send it onwards to another system, so relaying it on and kind of take over the identity of the authenticating to the other service. So it's kind of a general class of authentication relaying being a thing that the protocol design permits. And we've seen, you know, so many instances of that particular primitive over the years. You know, in the old days, you could just take, you know, kind of like outbound web requests from Internet Explorer and use them to authenticate to the file sharing service, you know, through the automated Windows auth, which, you know, kind of gradually got fixed. And so this one is another example of that mechanism where, you know, you can force an outbound authentication to occur, catch it, relay it. In this case, in the like encrypted file system mechanism, EFS RPC, It's also interesting that you can do it without any domain auth to start with, which, you know, most Active Directory attacks, you have to kind of have a regular user account, which is obviously not a high bar to start with. And this one's also interesting because we've seen it teed up with, I think it was SpectreOps's work on using Active Directory certificate services to then escalate up to privileged access onwards, you know, using a relayed attack. So those two together have been a pretty powerful thing. And we've seen a lot of, people being pretty shocked to see, you know, out of the box Windows 2019, you know, Server 2019 domain controller, straight up Prevest code exec job done in its default configuration. And then when you go and turn the remote file system, FSRPC services off, it doesn't appear to make it not work. So that's also concerning. It's just a, it's
been Microsoft, a real bad time. Microsoft settings be like that, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, between the, world readable SAM file and, this petty protam, and there's been some other examples of other relaying primitives, because, I mean, this general relay primitive in Active Directory is kind of a design flaw that, they really are struggling to fix.
Just bear with me a second here, because if I'm understanding you correctly, this is a technique that gives you network, that takes network access and turns it into domain admin?
Yes.
So you remember when NSA found a crypto bug that would give you RCE and network access to domain admin? It was huge news. Huge news. Everyone freaking out, running around with their hair on fire. This seems to be roughly equivalent to that. And it's not really getting much traction in the media.
I mean, it's certainly getting a lot of traction amongst the bits of InfoSec Twitter and red teamers, and I'm sure we'll see ransomware crews using it. But
sure,
yeah. I mean, this has been, there's probably half a dozen examples of basically this flow of some way to relay auth to some other service that we can then use to escalate privilege, be it through AD certificate services or through all sorts of other things. I mean, we've seen, I know engagements here, for example, we've done the bit where you take an outbound authentication request and relay it to the LDAP service and use that to modify, permissions in the Active Directory or something like that. So there's, any outbound auth connect from a high privileged system that you can then relay to another service to do something, you can kind of bolt those two pieces together and turn it into whatever you want. And that's, there's been, HTML was doing that in mid-2000s,
He's been tweeting about this going, he's looking a bit nostalgic in his tweets on this one. Microsoft has released some mitigation advice for this one, but how many people are actually going to go through the steps?
Well, I mean, this has been a really hard one, for them to solve in the past. I guess it's kind of what I alluded to, because it's sort of a design issue that they can point fix in each individual case. And so, for example, they dealt with the, HTTP to SMB relaying so that you couldn't do it, with some extra. But it used to be you could do it to the same service. So you could take outbound, SMB and then redirect it back to the same box and auth straight back to the file sharing on the machine that was making an outbound connection. So they made it so you couldn't do it to the same service. So then we did it cross service and then they made that more complicated. So it's just been it's difficult for them to address this comprehensively. And it's also been really fiddly.
Their primary thing when they're talking about mitigating this is just to disable NTLM. I mean, how practical is that advice? Is that something that most Windows domains these days, you can just switch it off and you're okay?
I mean, for a relatively modern domain, yes, you can get away with moving to pure Kerberos, leaving the NTLM out. Certainly integrating with third-party appliances and anything that's, Kerberos is fiddly and people don't necessarily understand. So there's a lot of, desire for people who are integrating with other components that are non-AD, non-Microsoft, to use old ways of authing. But yeah, if you were doing a Greenfields AD build, not that you would, you'd go Azure AD. But I mean, if you were doing even a relatively recent on-prem Windows domain, you can absolutely, go pure Kerberos and not have to deal. But, most big corp Active Directories, date from, NT351, NT4, they're maybe not 351, maybe NT4 kind of, that vintage, Windows 2000, yeah. Windows 2003, that's the where all of this infrastructure was built. And here we are stuck with it 20 years later. And, Windows Kerberos has been around for almost that long as well. And we're only still, you know, kind of it's the new way of authoring, even though it's also 20 years old.
Yeah. So, yeah. But it's less sucky, I guess. I mean, well, it's sucky in different ways. But I guess I got to get some, I got to figure out some joke about the giant ancient redwoods in the AD forest. yeah, I'll figure something out.
I mean, you know, these days I think Active Directory is probably not a thing that's ever going to be up for the job we've given it in this kind of security.
But
sense,
I really
right?
do worry I mean, about Azure AD, right? Because it just seems like they've ported over a lot of the dumb stuff into the
It's
into
a lot
the
of eggs
stuff.
In one basket, man.
It I mean, is.
You know, because it's one thing to have, you know, all everyone, each individual corporate's AD being trash, right? And if you get a, you know, local access to the network or you work there, you can escalate probe and do bad things. Like, I mean, that's the case at the moment with all of the ADs. But, you know, one big Azure AD.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I'm less worried about that because they've got a pretty, I'm guessing they've got a pretty good SOC team keeping an eye on that, right? So,
well, that's one of the advantages of centralizing is you do get great visibility and they get the ability to respond well and, you know, there's benefits, but.
I'm just more worried about like flaws in Azure AD, right? And like, you know, techniques that are going to work against it because it, you know, it's preserved some old thinking.
Yeah. And I think, you know, people are so used to their domains being fundamentally internal and not reachable from the internet. Whereas in Azure, obviously it's all, you know, if you had a bug in Azure AD, you can compromise anyone and everyone all at once.
Yeah. From
and
anywhere.
You know, you're going to get, you know, you're going to get caught, right? Because Microsoft, you know, has the visibility and they'll be able to react, but all you got to do is outrun them. And if you make enough noise, like if you had one, if you were China going after, you know, Lockheed to steal keys, like, you know, so they broke into RSA and did that supply chain wise. If you were China and you wanted to go after Lockheed again, why not hack everybody in Azure at once to make noise? And then, you know, you bought yourself time to go, you know, hit the target you really care about.
Yeah, but surely just doing one quietly, you know, you've got a pretty small chance of getting snapped.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, one quiet is one way of doing it. But I mean, if you're pretty confident you're going to get snapped, then you consider your other options, right?
Yeah.
And chaffing it, making a bunch of noise, making, you know, really ruining things on one side of the network so everyone's busy whilst you do the quiet thing over there. You know, these are human attackers, right? I mean, it's the land of Sun Tzu, right? They know how to think about this stuff.
It's funny. I just heard the voice of the Lockheed SOC staff saying, "Shut up," basically.
I'm sorry. You got your kill chains though. You'll be sweet.
Next time, just use example.com, you know.
Right, yes, example.com.
Or Acme Corporation, whatever.
Contoso, yes.
Moving on, we got a piece from Andy Greenberg at Wired. Look, this is a pretty tired debate, but I feel like we can probably weigh in on it a little bit. There's a site called Punk Spider, which is a little bit controversial. Tell us why.
So imagine Shodan, you know, a thing that scans a whole bunch of stuff on the internet and publishes the results so that you can search through it, you know, as a researcher or attacker or whatever, but actually did web app vuln assessment as well. So this is a project that's been going on for a while, but it's been given a bit of a refresh lately as it's gotten a bit more funding. But yeah, they crawl the internet, they scan for, you know, SQL injection and cross-site scripting and a bunch of other kind of basic web app stuff to the extent that you can, you know, with a pretty low complexity sort of scanner. You can only do so much if you're going to scan every site on the internet, publish up all the results. Obviously, this has got the usual debate going on about, you know, A, should you publish the results of this kind of work? And, you know, we've got the examples of Shodan and Google and, you know, other projects that have published bulk scanning data. Then there's the, are you doing crimes, right? I mean, by trying out unsolicited web app testing, you're just trying to do hacking, right? You're hacking every web server on the planet. Not those web servers did not consent to that. You've done crimes. So there's that kind of aspect to it.
Well, then there's the this is grossly irresponsible because essentially you're coming up with a list of vulnerable websites available to all and sundry, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, well, yes, exactly. And that they are, the people who run the site are, you know, kind of saying that this is necessary to improve herd health, you know, by exposing everybody's
weaknesses. It's the cleansing fire that allows the forest to regrow. And I find that's a bit of a tired argument, to be honest.
And I mean, you know, having written internet scale crawlers and done, you know, that kind of scanning myself and not published the results because I guess I felt that the positive outcomes you desire, right, of improving herd health are a possible outcome, and the negatives of a whole bunch of people are going to get a whole bunch of owned and wrecked.
That's a certain outcome.
Outcome, right? And you're weighing up a, you know, like 0.3% likelihood of a good thing happening versus 100% likelihood of a bad thing happening. You do your, you know, probabilistic risk assessment math, and you come out as this is probably a bad idea. And that's certainly where I landed on it, right? It was useful for me.
Well, that's why I wanted to get your thoughts on this because, you know, for those who don't know, Adam did a, you know, internet-wide scanning project called Low-Hanging Kiwi Fruit many, many years ago. And, you know, when you finish, I remember you doing the talk and you're like, you know, if you want a login to this thing, you know, talk to me, but I'm not just going to put it out on the internet Shodan style because some of the stuff you were turning up was pretty like, hey.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, you know, mine was roughly contemporaneous with Shodan. I mean, I went more protocol specific depth. So like if it found an open network share, like it would actually list all the files there. If it found an LDAP server, it would dump the LDAP tree out. So all stuff that didn't require auth, but, you know, kind of collected a bit more depth, you know, than Shodan was doing at the time. And yeah, like, I mean, it felt irresponsible to just, I mean, sure, everyone else can go build it, right? And people have, you know, lots of other people have built that kind of bulk scanning and, you know, people can do what they like with it. But, you know, it was given how much we used that at work to go own stuff, like it was pretty clear that it was a thing that would get you owned, right? Get other people owned. And,
yeah,
you know,
don't give machine guns to the toddlers, I think is the
pretty much, you know,
is the idea there. Yeah. Oh, well, that's the hot take from risky.biz on that one, because I have seen people sort of, you know, having a bit of a chat about that on the Twitters. Moving on. And, you know, we got some more research out of the Russian company Positive Technologies, which has a habit of publishing some pretty great research for unknown motives often. But yeah, they've Catalan's got a write up here of a biometrics like physical access solution vendor called IDEMIA. Yeah, there's a bunch of like, you know, shitty RCE and typical IoT style bugs in that stuff. And yeah, it's pretty funny.
Yeah, so I think they're a French vendor that does, you know, hand geometry readers and hand vein biometrics. You know, it's a pretty high security stuff and I imagine probably sell to, you know, French government, amongst other things. And so, yeah, seeing Positive Technology show up with like straight up mem corruption buffer overflows in their network protocol, pretty funny. You know, if you've got biometric gear in your high security data centers, et cetera, then, you know, maybe go look at the brand name on it and make sure you're patched.
Yeah, I mean, it's the sort of stuff that would make for good movie hacking, right?
Yes.
But you sort of wonder how much people have used it.
Well, you know, but Positive Tech do seem to come up with things that people actually use.
Yeah.
There's a degree of practicality in their work.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing with Positive. You never know if it's just research they've done or if they're burning like some CIA tool that they found in the wild, right? Like, you just don't know. It's fun. Brian Krebs has a great write-up here about this guy, Joseph O'Connor, a.k.a. Plug Walk Joe. He has been arrested as a part of the mass hack of Twitter accounts last year. This is the crypto scam where, you know, they posted as Joe Biden saying, you know, I'm going to send you some Bitcoin. And, you know, apparently they scored a few $1,000 out of that or whatever. What's interesting though is, you know, we had spoken about these guys and like, you know, surely some of these are just idiot kids and whatever. Brian's done a really good job of writing up what a nasty little psychopath this guy is. It's pretty sobering reading.
Yeah, exactly. I guess we always want to believe that it's just, you know, punk hacker kids doing the sort of punk hacker stuff that, you know, I'm not saying any of us did that in our youths, but, you know, the sort of, you know, trad classic punk hacker stuff. And this, yeah, this is really just not it. I mean, this kid was involved with like swatting people and extorting people. Like this kid and his friends stole, you know, nude photos from some actress's Snapchat account and tried to blackmail her. And, you know, there's just some really just, like swatted cops that were investigating them, like some just really, yeah.
Well, and intimated to Brian Krebs that if he named him, you know, his friends were going to hire someone to go beat the crap out of him. So, you know, he's a nasty, nasty dude.
Yeah. And which, I mean, that's a lot of nasty for 22. Like that's, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, what does that I say mean, about that's a lot of wrong turns pretty quick,
that
right?
Is a lot of wrong turns, yeah.
But, you know, so that's the internet, though. It does turn people, yeah. Like people's internet personas can be pretty gross, right? Like Ross Ulbricht is the perfect example because by all reports, IRL, he was just lovely, right? But he was just an utter psychopath as Dread Pirate Roberts.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, you give people anonymity and you give them a bunch of, you know, ability to exert power remotely and too much money and all that kind of thing. Yeah, you definitely, yeah, power corrupts, what they say, right?
Yeah. Well, I think he's going to find himself in a somewhat reversed situation in prison because he doesn't look particularly threatening in the pictures.
No, he doesn't. So he was arrested, I think, in Spain, looking for extradition to the US. So, yeah, I think he's going to have a bad time.
Yeah, I agree. Moving on, and this story, another one from Catalin Kimpanu over at The Record. This one just did my head in because they're talking about an APT crew called Praying Mantis, which is apparently targeting IIS servers with some ASP.NET exploits, and it looks like pretty good hacking. But the thing is, like the third bullet point in the deck on this story says, Praying Mantis leveraged four old exploits as entry point and then pivoted to internal networks. And I'm like, wait, what? How are you pivoting to internal networks from IIS boxes that are on the internet? That doesn't make any sense. And then I remembered that people suck and it all made sense.
Then you remember that Active Directory exists.
Yeah.
Yes. So, I mean, certainly there's nothing new from a point of view of bugs. I mean, this is like old Telerik, ASP.NET web framework bugs and that kind of thing. But yeah, it is just kind of funny to see, you know, how basic it is. Like the fact that, you know, hitting a web server, pivoting across, you know, the poorly designed DMZ, if at all, ending up in the internal network and on you go. I mean, that's a pretty classic way of doing it. You know, that's the old, you know, kind of mid-2000s way of hacking stuff. And, you know, totally still works because, hey, Active Directory.
But like a well-architected DMZ from 20 years ago would stop this from working.
It would until you started using Active Directory because now you've got to allow all of the AD bits through from your DMZ, or you end up joining the, you know, domain in the DMZ to the domain in the middle of the network, or you have trust. Yeah, it all goes horribly wrong.
Yeah, yeah. Sigh. We just got a couple here that kind of dovetail nicely. Apparently APT31, the Chinese group, has been using a mesh of home routers as jump points to do recon and launch attacks and stuff, which is pretty funny. And meanwhile, an Estonian guy has pleaded guilty this week in court in Alaska. There's got to be a story there. He's pleaded guilty for proxying traffic for a whole bunch of crime groups as well. Were they through some botnet? Was that just a typical Windows botnet, that one?
I think they were actually compromising routers. I assume it's one of the kind of derived from Mirai sort of, you know, like Telnet brute forcey, compromise people's home routers and then build a proxy overlay network and sell onwards access to it, you know, like a legit VPN firm.
Dan Gooden at Ars Technica has reported that, and this is a funny story, right? So Ukrainian authorities had basically seized a bunch of servers from a, you know, one of those sort of semi-shady VPN services. And it turned out their encryption keys for their actual VPN service were just sitting on the disk. So, you know, Ukrainian authorities just snagged the keys and that would allow them to do active person-in-the-middle attacks. He's just got a good write-up here. But you pointed out to me that the CEO of the VPN company turns up in the comments and actually has some good responses.
Yeah, it's actually quite an interesting story because, I mean, there's so many VPN operators being, you know, advertised to people on YouTube or on the, you know, around the internet, and lots of people are being, you know, fooled into thinking they need VPNs to stop this exact kind of situation happening. And all the VPN providers say, hey, we don't store keys, we don't have logs, blah, 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 blah. And in this case, right, they did have keys. But yeah, what was interesting is the chief exec or director or something of the company shows up in the Ars comments to answer the questions and has some really good answers, right? I mean, he said, you know, the server was old, you know, we were in the process of migrating to a new key management system, you know, we're moving to a new thing with WireGuard, we're doing this and this. This had a, you know, bunch of pretty good technical answers. Also explained that their proxy service had been used to do some attacks against like some fraud, tax fraud or something in Ukraine, which is why the police had rolled up and stolen the proxy. So bad luck for the person who did crime in Ukraine through a proxy in Ukraine.
Seems a bit silly, doesn't it?
If you're going to subscribe to a VPN service to avoid jurisdictional issues, like maybe use one that's not in your target jurisdiction anyway. But then, you know, so it's actually really nice, you know, when you get companies showing up, you know, in the comments and, you know, doing, that's much better PR than a we take your security really seriously, except that the guy has been an Ars forum member for I think 6 or 7 years according to his forum profile, and his username is Moist Gerbil.
Moist Gerbil, one word. You just gotta love it. It feels horrible just saying that, doesn't it?
It's a good really way does. To say it.
But I'm surprised actually sometimes at how much talent, because, you know, a lot of these VPN providers are utter trash, right? Like they're just terrible. But occasionally, you know, one of them will put out some technical blog post or something that's really interesting. I remember Private Internet Access, you know, PIA, they're one of the biggest sort of VPN providers. They've got some really good people on staff because there was some set of bugs that came out that affected various VPN tech and, you know, their analysis was just on point. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. There is a bunch of technical plumbing involved with making these services work well and scale, right? I mean, yeah. Like these VPN providers do. You know, it's not uncomplicated work. So
no, it's hard work. It's just mostly pointless.
it's not pointless. Like you get to fleece people out of $3 a year or whatever, but.
You know what I mean, Adam.
From a security point of view, a little bit pointless.
Now, our skateboarding dog this week is a rather unhinged dude who used to work for the CIA by the name of Joshua Schulte. He faced trial, of course, for being the so-called Vault 7 source for WikiLeaks. Prosecution put forward a what I thought was a pretty compelling case, but it ended in a mistrial because his defense lawyer was very, very good. Might go a bit differently this time, given that he has apparently chosen to represent himself at his next trial. And I reckon we need to crowdfund... so that we can get this thing televised because, you know, get your popcorn. It'll be hilarious because this guy is weird.
Yeah, like we've seen a bunch of stories about this guy and how, you know, somewhat unhinged he is. And I think even the judge has been maybe warning him gently that maybe representing yourself, in a normal case, not the best idea. And in this guy's particular case, you know, getting access to the evidence when he's in prison to be able to prepare it seems like a bad idea. It's going to be a mess.
Well, I mean, enough rope, right? Like, you know, or who knows, maybe he's become an excellent jailhouse lawyer. We'll just have to wait and see.
Possible.
But Adam, that's actually it for the week's news. Thank you so much for joining us as always. And we'll chat to you again next week.
Yeah, cheers. I'll talk to you then, Pat.
That was Adam Boileau there with a check of the week's security news. And also, just while I think to mention it, don't forget to subscribe to the Risky Business newsletter, Seriously Risky Biz. I will drop a link into this week's show notes so you can find it. It goes out via Substack. So Tom Uren is our new editor there, and he's done a great job this week of covering a somewhat alarming story about a Catholic priest in the USA who was outed by a Catholic publication as a Grindr user, but outed through commercially available app data. And that is pretty chilling stuff. And we didn't really have room in the podcast for it, but Tom's done an excellent job with some analysis on that one. So you can read all about that tomorrow in the Seriously Risky Biz newsletter. Moving on, we are about to chat with Paul Lanzi, the co-founder of Remediant. Remediant makes a PAM solution that is less infuriating to use than a traditional password vault solution. Their product is, just easier to get up and running as well. You can drop it in as a network appliance and it'll go out and automatically remove privilege from accounts in your environment and then restore it on a time-locked basis as you need it. So it's like a just-in-time admin type of thing. They also have EDR integrations that you can do some cool stuff with, which also means they don't need to ship an agent because they're using the EDR, which funnily enough has made analysts kind of discount them as a true PAM vendor because they don't have an agent. But that's because they don't actually need one. And that's kind of what this conversation is going to be about. Remediant's approach is a new way to tackle an old problem. So naturally, business is good. And they even got a note from Gartner recently. They were named as an honorable mention. But as you'll hear, analyst land isn't exactly moving with the times when it comes to ranking PAM solutions. So Paul Lanzi joined me to talk a little bit about that. And here he is.
Yeah. So Gartner's definition of PAM, and those of you that have a Gartner subscription can read the actual inclusion criteria, but it basically requires that you have an agent, that you are a password vault solution, that you basically look exactly like the players that have been in the PAM market for the last 20 years. And that's a real challenge for little startups like us that trying to take a different approach, right? So we're agentless or vaultless. Those are things that disqualify us from the Magic Quadrant. But I think being named as an honorable mention in the Gartner publication really shows about how this market is evolving. Now, when you look at PAM on the hype cycle, right? So PAM is at the far end of the hype cycle. I think it's one of the last two or three is on the far right.
Well, it's as old as the hills, really, the PAM market, right?
It's older than email, actually. Like, people were solving privilege access management problems before email existed. This is not a new category, right? But I think it's the approach. The problem set is probably not that much different, right? How do you protect accounts that have more access than normal accounts do? That's the fundamental problem to be solved. But the approach to go solve that problem has evolved significantly, and it feels like maybe the analyst community is still catching up with that.
I feel like this is a conversation that's bigger than just PAM, though, right? Because what we have seen is for a long time, we just had these established vendors making established tech. So you'd have big four antivirus companies, you'd have like a handful of firewall companies, you'd have a handful of PAM companies, right? Like that was the status quo for so long. And now all of a sudden, not only do you have people doing new things, doing things like PAM or AV in new ways or EPP in new ways, but you've got entire categories of technology that didn't even exist a while ago. And like one of them that you and I were discussing previously, just before we started recording, is like asset detection and management. How do you begin to put that on a mystical quadrangle? Are you talking about internal asset discovery, external? Like, does it need to integrate with an asset database? Like, things are changing.
Yeah, well, I feel in that specific category, the industry have failed so long to solve the CMDB problem, or CMDB was a failed attempt at solving a problem, that is what opened up or left space for some of these new emerging asset discovery and cybersecurity asset management tools, you know, the Axoniuses, the Rumbles of the world, Rumble Runs of the world to emerge and really to shake that space up, which it desperately needs shaking up. Because again, that's a very old problem that has remained unsolved. And I think the analysts really struggle to keep up with that. And I think rightly so.
Because keeping up requires kind of a bit of a rethink of how they do things, right? I think it's a lot easier to come up with, you know, geometrically pleasing charts when you're dealing with a bunch of companies who do everything the same.
Yeah, for sure. If they all take the same approach, it's easier to rank them.
Yeah.
At how well they do that.
Yeah, and then you're ranking based on features and like quality of dev and, you know, functionality. Never on code quality because, that's too hard.
That is very hard. I think one of the challenges being an analyst, again, I don't envy analysts their job, is that they're often led by the customers, right? So their customers are the actual buyers of these solutions, right? This is a two-sided marketplace where they have a foot in the vendor market and they have a foot in the consumer market. And the consumers are telling the analysts, hey, this is the stuff we're interested in buying. And it tends not to be the cutting edge stuff because that's how they have to find out about that stuff. And so I think it's a real challenge for analysts to look beyond what their customers are actually buying today and think about what are the unfilled needs that their buyers still need to think about tomorrow.
Now, we had you on the show a while ago where you were talking about actually using your PAM solution like in a rapid deployment during incident response to try to evict ransomware, which the idea of using like a centralized agentless PAM to remove privilege from attackers in a very quick way and actually get PAM happening. Yeah, it was very, very cool stuff. But you were just telling me that you've actually, you know, you had to sort of tweak the product a little bit for that use case. And as a result of that, it's kind of become more suitable for SMEs, right? Because you've traditionally played in the very large enterprise space, but now because you kind of developed it for an IR use case, it's made it more suitable for smaller companies. Why is that?
Yeah, this falls definitely under that category of we are not the smartest people in the room, right? Our customers, our buyers actually teach us a lot about how our technology can be used. And thanks for the kind compliment there about the incident response recording we did. It was also one of my favorite ones to do with you. And it was great to talk through some of those examples. You know, finding the simplicity inside of the complexity is something that I've been trying to do my entire life. And trying to bring simplicity to the privileged access management market is exactly why we started Remedient, why Tim and I started Remedient. I don't think that we're there yet. I don't think we'll ever get to 100% achievement of like perfect simplicity around this. But like you said, we were able to simplify enough of the onboarding and initial setup of the product, of our product, so that it could be deployed in the matter of minutes and get control over ransomware that was spreading using compromised privilege.
And that's what small to medium enterprises want, right? They don't want something that is a project to spin up, which in a large enterprise, it doesn't matter which PAM solution you're picking. It's a project, let's be honest. I mean, with you guys, it's probably going to be a bit shorter than a password vault project, but it's still a project. And what you're telling me now is this is something that's more like you can just drop it in.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I am a recovering IT project manager, so I have implemented many of these terrible projects, which is exactly why I wanted to create a solution that doesn't require one.
Well, I mean, part of the whole thing here is, this Remedient was sort of spun out of the trauma of people having to deal with password vaults, wasn't it?
Absolutely. My own trauma, my wife ran a technology team, her trauma, Tim's trauma. So yeah, absolutely. We We created the solution to the problem that we faced every day. That's certainly true.
Now, look, you mentioned that you got an honorable mention from Gartner in their Mystical Quadrangle for PAM solutions, which is, you know, great. It's always great when, you know, you're running a small company and you get that sort of nod, that sort of kudos. The other one that got an honorable mention is Microsoft. I'm just curious what got them in there.
Well, they have the same sort of qualification problem. So they also don't have a PAM agent. They also don't have a PAM password vault solution. You know, they have Microsoft Lapse, which is a free solution for being able to secure the built-in admin accounts, the Red 500 accounts on Windows servers and workstations. But it doesn't meet all the qualification criteria that Gartner has for this. Again, that have evolved over 20 years of the really big players establishing a sort of pattern, right? How do you solve this with password vaults? How do you solve this privileged access management problem with password vaults? And so, yeah, Microsoft also didn't qualify for the Magic Quadrant, which I like a lot.
Now, I got to ask, where is most of your business coming from? Is it greenfields or, you know, places that aren't currently using PAM, or is it rip and replace for the vault stuff?
Yeah, I think that we've had the most success with organizations that have had some kind of PAM experience, right? So they've deployed some sort of PAM solution in the past, and they found what they don't like about it, right? It's too complex. It's too hard to deploy. Like you said, it ends up being a project that takes 18 months or 24 months and only ever gets to 50% of its success criteria. There's a webinar I did about incident response and talked a little bit about some study data that we had that only 50% of PAM rollout projects, you know, using other technologies ever get to 50% of their original objectives. And so that means,
well, what are those objectives though? Because some of them could be, you know, nice to haves, not need to haves, right? The need to have is actually account coverage.
Yeah. Well, and that's what the study data was showing, was they weren't even getting to that, right? So they weren't even getting to that metric. They weren't even achieving 100% or even close to 100% account coverage. And so, you know, trying to do something different is exactly what was required, because trying to do password vaults faster or with more encryption or whatever, like you just can't optimize that strategy enough to make it successful. You have to take a different strategy.
It's probably worth repeating though, that if you stick your head into the average contemporary enterprise network and take a little look around, it's not like PAM is a solved problem. You know, and this is the thing, we're talking about a market that is as older than email, right? It's as old as the hills, and yet it's still, you know, we are not even close with actually getting people to use satisfactory PAM solutions. But I guess that is a product of the old approach being kind of a pain in the ass, right?
Yeah, a pain in the ass and just not scaling to things that are modern, like DevOps, right? If you're trying to use password vaults and you're trying to do things at the speed of DevOps, you know, good luck, it isn't going to happen. You know, you asked, you know, have you had more success with sort of greenfield or with existing PAM, deployed companies? In those existing PAM deployed companies, when we go in and do an initial scan to figure out how much privileged access there is in the environment, we find that on average, and again, take the average laptop, desktop, virtual machine, whatever, we find something like 450 accounts have persistent admin rights on it. And this is in organizations with something like 10,000 employees or so. 451 accounts is bananas, man. Like, that is crazy pants.
Yeah.
Like, that is way too much privileged access for any environment. And that's after they've deployed a PAM solution. So if you needed more proof that things aren't working the way that we've done them historically, I think that's it right for you.
Yeah, so it sounds like there's a little ways to go. What's your reflection? Because you've been going at this for a while, right? Like, Remediant is not a new startup anymore. What's your reflection on the speed at which this is happening? You know, because you're obviously growing, like, you're taking rounds, you're accelerating, et cetera, et cetera. Like, is uptake actually growing at the rate you expected? Is it faster? Is it slower? I'm just sort of curious for you, given that, you know, this is the world you're in.
Yeah, I think it's growing probably faster than I would have expected in a lot of ways. I think that, you know, 6 years ago when we started Remediant, we didn't really see DevOps coming as a major initiative and a major driver in the growth in the number of endpoints.
Well, I'm kind of surprised that DevOps is a driver of PAM as well, because I just would have thought, given that's all custom stuff, people kind of would have tried to roll their own their own protections around that stuff. I'm kind of surprised that a third party PAM solution is what's required there.
It's probably helpful. It may not be required, but if you're if you're a master of DevOps, right, and you're using Chef and Puppet, and you speak those sort of languages on a daily basis, you probably have rolled something on your own that is effective. But that's not true for the majority of organizations, right? So if you're a biotech and you're doing DevOps so you can do faster genome sequencing, like spending weeks trying to figure out how to do privileged access for your DevOps engineers doesn't make sense, right? It makes sense to just buy a solution like Remediance that actually solves that problem for you.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of those products, aren't there, that where they're doing stuff that you could do yourself, but it's just not worth the grief, right?
But also, it gets better over time.
I think PAM in a Windows context makes an awful lot of sense. You know, certainly the way that you do it. So I wouldn't recommend rolling your own there at all. But you know, you can kind of see my point, right? About like in the DevOps space. But then you've got companies like, you know, CMD, right? Do Linux security stuff, and you can probably, I mean, they're baking in more EDR style functionality into that, so this isn't as applicable anymore, but the early versions of their products, you could probably do that yourself, but like, why would you do that when you can buy it?
Yeah, well, and Remediant does this as well for Linux and Mac workstations too, and trying to get that granular level of control over sudo writes on those sort of endpoints, right, at scale. It turns out to be a hard problem to solve. I think we've solved it in a pretty innovative way, but it is the actual problem you have to solve if you're thinking about how do I do DevOps across 1,000 workloads that may be spun up tomorrow or maybe spun down the day after.
Yeah. All right, well, Paul Lanzi, thank you very much for joining us for a bit of a chat about, I guess, the broader PAM market and, you know, analyst firms and DevOps and all sorts of stuff. It's been very interesting. It's always a pleasure to chat to you, my friend, and we'll talk to you again soon.
All right. Cheers, Pat.
That was Paul Lanzi from Remediant there with a chat about PAM solutions, analysts, and what they've been up to. And you can find Remediant at remediant.com. That's R-E-M-E-D-I-A-N-T.com. And that is it for this week's show. I will be back on Monday with a soapbox edition of the podcast. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.